So now, without further ado, it's time to introduce our panel to you. And here's the host of our Silicon Valley PRSA blockbuster, internet and computer technology luminary, including a columnist for the Palo Alto Daily News and the San Jose Mercury News. And he's also the on-air analyst for CBS News, and that is Larry Magid.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. You know, one of the things that I love about public relations people is we journalists are much too annoying to have any real friends. So no matter how lonely we get in our real life, we can always count on you folks to give us a call. So now, back in the 90s, you used to call far too often. But that was because PR firms were recruiting directly out of high school back then. When Silicon Valley, you know, when all you had to do was put a .com after your name and you could suddenly get millions or billions of dollars in venture capital. And although none of us are happy about the decline that happened in the early part of the century, it did actually create a shakeout, which in some odd ways means that those of us who survived both on the journalism side, and many of our colleagues didn't, and those of us who survived on the PR side had to work a little harder, had to be a little smarter. And I think that as a result of it, as we go back into a what we hope to be a continually booming economy, we're going to see some great people on both sides of the equation. So do call, but please don't be too offended if I hang up on you 30 seconds later, probably because your caller ID is very close to one of the radio stations I report to, and I actually think it's one of my producers calling to tell me I should be on the air in the next 12 seconds, which is how I spend most of my day, as some of you know. In any case, it is a great pleasure to be here and to work with such a distinguished panel. I'm a little nervous because in addition to including several of my friends, it includes one of my ex-bosses and one of my current bosses. So if I seem like I'm sweating, I'll try not to. And speaking of current bosses, as you know, I'm now writing a column in the San Jose Mercury News, and David Satterfield, who is way above the food chain of my level, is the managing editor. And before that, he worked at the Miami Herald, but he takes no responsibility for the butterfly ballot. So David, come on, and let's see if put you on the hot seat.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, a pleasure. And we're hoping that the ratings are high enough that we get another season out of this. Well, David, you are the managing editor for Silicon Valley's newspaper of record, of course, the largest newspaper in the area and one that we all read every day. What do you see from the standpoint of the Valley in terms of the business climate and the tech climate?
Well, I think it's, after the bust of 2000-2001, I think the Valley has come back slowly but is now moving along at a very good pace. I mean, I think what we've seen is there hasn't been a tremendous amount of job growth in the technology industry, but we've seen, you know, a lot of jobs offshore, and companies have really been able to take that cost control and the cuts they made in 2000-2001, and now particularly with the real strong rise in sort of consumer technology, Valley companies are benefiting greatly from that. So we're actually seeing companies reporting, you know, record profits, record revenues. It's really a bright time in the Valley. If you look at the stock prices of companies like Hewlett Packard and Cisco and Apple, they've all hit sort of all-time highs.
But you did hint at something that's a bit disturbing when you mentioned offshoring. In terms of the employment picture, in terms of what really makes the Valley grow, the people, what are your feelings?
Well, we're never going to see manufacturing in the Valley again, and that's a lot of manufacturing and, you know, customer service sort of operations have gone offshore and are going to stay offshore. Mm-hmm. We're just the Valley is too much of a high cost place to see a lot of that work return here. So the work that's going to be done here is going to be the corporate headquarters type work, marketing, accounting, you know, the CEO kinds of operations. And I think we'll still see a lot of engineering, and the real strength of the Valley is startups, and we have that amazing sort of recipe of venture capitalists, great universities, and this culture of just entrepreneurialism that, you know, will continue to get startups, and with everything that's happening in video, in chip technology, you know, in software, we're going to continue to get startups.
Now, David, you're a former business editor, and of course you oversee the entire editorial staff, so as you sit every day to kind of decide what to cover and what to look for in terms of what's important, what do you see as being the kind of key stories, key products that you want to focus your newspaper on?
Well, I think, you know, particularly for us, you have to pay a lot of attention to you know, the sort of Valley stalwarts, which is, you know, Intel, Cisco, and now, of course, Google and Yahoo. But, you know, I think the big area right now to really pay a lot of attention to is video. You know, we saw what happened with YouTube and Google, and that sort of user-generated video. But, you know, we're on the cusp of a lot of interesting things happening with sort of the high-content video, where you're, rather than being sort of a slave to the television, we're now getting to the point where you can watch what you want to watch, when you want to watch it, and I think that's going to drive a lot of technological growth.
We only have a little time left, but one last question. You're in the newspaper industry. It's been a tough few years in the newspaper industry, and in fact, the company that you work for, I'm not even sure what it's called anymore because it keeps changing names, but what do you see as the role of print versus all the other medias and the role of your business going forward?
Well, I would, the role of print, I think the print newspaper will be around because there are people who, you know, there's a portability to the newspaper. You know, you can take the newspaper places where you can't sort of take a computer. You know, I won't get specific about where that is. But
the train.
The train is perfect. But there are places. We're in the midst of a transformation from print to online. But we're really going to remain an information company, and we're going to remain a local information company. And so we just have to get wise about how do we deploy our resources to cover the local stories that no one else is going to cover.
And just as a comment, one of the things you've done to those of us who write for newspapers is we now have to be writers, podcasters, videographers. It's really changed the whole nature of what we do.
Absolutely.
And speaking of changing nature, Fortune magazine keeps us on top of changes on a regular basis, and we're very pleased to have Jeffrey O'Brien, who's the senior editor of Fortune, that covers business, society, and science. He's also been with Wired, Marketing Computers, and this really surprised me, The Village Voice. So, Jeffrey, come on down. So just as David represents the local picture, I guess Fortune kind of represents the national picture. So let's look at kind of national trends for business and technology, really, as we look back at 2006. In fact, let's start off with what do you see was sort of the biggest story of 2006 and what's going to be the biggest story of 2007, if you can speculate.
Okay, sure. No softballs.
These were all unrehearsed, by the way. Nobody knew what's coming.
Biggest story of 2006, I'd have to say Web 2.0, I mean, mm-hmm. Don't you think? I mean, sure, Fortune is national, and so everything I write is going to have that broad scope, but I'm here for a reason. And so I spent, you know, almost 7 years at Wired chained to my desk editing features, and I went over to Fortune for the opportunity to write because I feel like things are starting to get exciting again, and I really wanted to be part of it. I wanted to be, you know, sort of pressing the flesh with people like you and your clients, and you know, Web 2.0 really, I think, is a manifestation of that excitement that I'm feeling. It's, you know, the platform has been built. You know, everything that we were all excited about in 1999 about the potential of the internet, you know, to change the world. It wasn't unfounded. I mean, it was hyperbolic, you know, and it was frothy and it was crazy. But it was, you know, if you go out 20 years from now and you look back to the stuff we were saying in 1999, I think that, you know, maybe we were undershooting, you know? I mean, maybe Dora was right. I mean, now that that foundation has been laid, you know, what's really fascinating to me about what's happening in the Valley now is not just, when I say Web 2.0, I don't just mean, you know, Ajax and sort of, you know, mashups and stuff like that. I mean, very broadly, this sense of tapping into, you know, crowdsourcing, as we called it at Wired, you know, tapping into the community, letting them do the work for you. And what I'm seeing in the Valley is, like, you know, the Valley has grown up creating products, you know, Fairchild, Cisco, Intel, making hardware. You know, we've been saying this for a while, it's fading into the background. But what's next is that, you know, this is what's so amazing about the Valley, is we have these creative thinkers, these engineers, you know, these brilliant MBAs, you know, who are just all kind of coming together and applying their creativity to whatever, you know, whatever's making money or what can ever change the world at that point in time. And I think that, that what's happening now is no longer hardware, but right, they're applying their skills outside.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question on Web 2.0, sure, because it presents a challenge for everyone in this room. For you and me and David and the rest of our panelists, it means that we're not the only pundits in the world. That Web 2.0 makes it possible for everyone to have a blog, everyone to have a comment, everyone to be a video star, an audio star. And it also means for the folks, the rest of the folks in this room, that when you look for the influencers, the people who can influence buying decisions, for example, again, you don't just go through Bacon's Rolodex and call up the guys from Fortune and the Mercury News and CBS News. So what impact is that going to have on the whole way, on the whole marketing world and the whole way that we cover technology?
Well, you know, they don't need me to tell them. I mean, you know, when everybody has, you know, the proverbial printing press, everybody has the power that, you know, someone in the media had. I mean, it's really interesting, the relationship between the blogging community and mainstream journalists. And, you know, I mean, it's, we all, you know, on both sides like to think and write about, you know, is, you know, there's antagonism sometimes, there's cooperation other times. I mean, I really think about it as sort of, you know, mainstream journalism is like, if you imagine, you know, media broadly like the auto industry, mainstream journalism is like GM, you know, hopefully, well, probably on the same downward spiral, but GM is providing a living. I mean, they're doing the hard work, and, you know, in a lot of ways, they're doing the manufacturing, they're doing the presenting, but they're providing a living for all their suppliers. What, you know, what I see so often is, you know, I'll write a piece, whether it's a web piece or, you know, one in the magazine, and then everybody picks up on it, it has little, you know, comments, yeah, and sends it around, and then it just sort of, it comes to life. And so, but I'm out there, I'm up and down the Valley doing like hard reporting, real reporting, and you know, trying to generate real news and real insight, yeah, and then everybody else sort of takes a piece of it. But for you know, for you all in the room, you know, my piece may be important, but I may have missed something, or you know, that's the thing. It's like, as you well know, it's like you have this whole crowd of intelligence pick up on something you wrote, and then you go, oh, damn, I missed that, you know, or they exposed something, you know, a faulty line of thinking. So they have the same sort of power that I do, in aggregate, I think, that I do. We're serving different missions, but for you and your clients, it's the same net effect.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you very much. I guess it's time for us to come up with our hybrid so we're relevant, as GM is trying to do. Steve Fox is editor-in-chief of InfoWorld, and I started reading InfoWorld back in the late 70s to show my age. Very influential paper. Prior to that, he's been around CNET, editor-in-chief of PC World, web magazine, a very influential person. Focuses more on the enterprise, which I think is also a very important aspect of the Valley.
So you started reading when you were 3 years old.
When I was 3 years old, and my parents sort of, that's how I learned the alphabet, not Dr. Spock, but John Dvorak, I think, was my guru at the time. Steve, let's think about the enterprise. You know, there was a time when that was all we talked about, but really consumer technology is very much on the front burner. Yet at the same time, from a financial standpoint, enterprise technology is incredibly important. In fact, Microsoft just yesterday released Vista not first to consumers, but to enterprise. And I think that says something. So tell us about sort of the business of covering business.
Yeah, well, you know, we certainly at InfoWorld, we think that that enterprise is the engine behind all this. I mean, if I were to look at at last year as the big, the biggest enterprise trend, it would have to be what was going on with service-oriented architecture, which is a real maturing of this. And this is basically taking applications, exposing them as services that can be, consumed, exposing things through standardized interfaces. It allows hooking up of everything, these services, legacy applications, and new habits. So there was a tremendous maturation, and it kind of became the standard way that applications and the like are built. This is what happened really over the last 2 years, and you're going to see a lot more of that going forward. I think the interesting piece, and Jeff, you were talking about Web 2.0, and just because we're an enterprise, we want to get some of the fun stuff too, and there happens to be some Web 2.0 stuff going on there. What you're seeing now is a lot of enterprise applications are being exposed, in a rich interface, through a browser. You've got Ajax and other tools that makes this possible. So you'll have, what you'll see is more and more of this merging of SOA as kind of a, back-end architectural thing, combining with the Web 2.0 stuff. So those are going to be merging. We get to get both trends and have some fun with it.
One of the interesting things about enterprise is it doesn't tend to be as fast-moving, even though it has advanced technology. And I remember going back to the 80s, people talking about the IT department, borrowing a team from Steve Jobs, somewhat being the orifice through which things pass through at a very, very constricted rate.
That's orifice, not office. Yeah.
Yes, orifice. So how does one influence enterprise? How does one get enterprise to kind of move from its sluggish pace?
Well, I mean, you kind of recognize that none of this stuff happens overnight, right? I mean, in many ways, for covering it, it's a lot easier. Back when I did a lot of the more consumer stuff, 6 months was a lifetime, and that was it. Here, you've got product cycles that tend to be a year and a half and the like. So it's kind of good news for those pitching these stories because there's more lifetime on it. As far as influencing it, it's just a matter of figuring out what the trends are and covering those right companies and products. There's amazing M&A stuff going on that has completely roiled the enterprise market. You look last year, it started off with Mercury buys Cisternet, then HP buys Mercury, and one fish keeps on eating another fish. IBM's involved, everyone's involved. Just so you need a scorecard for that. But that's definitely a big part of covering it is figuring out who the players are and when, and that's the trick.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for your perspective. And speaking of big fish, I think the biggest fish in the business daily publication world nationally has to be the Wall Street Journal. We're very pleased to have Don Clark, who's the deputy bureau chief of the journal, been there since 1993. He's covered technology also for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I didn't know this, the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Now I'm really impressed. Don?
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I guess we're having a little audio problems. Are you ever able to hear now?
I think we hear you. So I'm going to ask you the same question at lunch. Tell us what the stock prices are going to be in 2007.
Well, I could. You just give me a ticker symbol. I'll tell you
it right out. Well, we'll do this later because if you give it out here, it'll the world. I'm curious from your perspective, covering the Valley and really the whole Bay Area for the Journal. What are you looking back at 2006? What do you see with the big story?
Well, 2006, one has to think about the HP pretexting scandal.
Yes.
So, I was sitting there minding my own business and my mild-mannered colleague, Pui Wing Tam, got the word from the state attorney general that she had been pretexted. And so suddenly my life was ruined because she was part of the story and so couldn't write the story. So I had to start writing the story. And so I have.
By the way, were you jealous?
No, I wasn't. But I had a feeling that that story will not be repeated in 07. So.
Yeah, no. I was kind of hurt that I wasn't pretexted at all, but that's okay. In terms of looking forward, and I know you're not really a product guy, you leave that to Walt and Kara and some of the others, but what do you see as kind of the emerging product technology, the product categories?
Well, I'm kind of the chip guy at the Journal now as far as what I actually write about, and so I thought I would just throw out this idea. We've been talking about the Valley, and Moore's Law is kind of like the Valley's modus operandi. Everything gets, The trouble with Moore's Law is it's kind of variously interpreted, kind of like the Bible, to mean whatever people want it to mean. And one of the things people thought it meant was that your chip kept getting a faster clock speed, and your program would automatically go faster. But actually what Moore's Law just says is we will be able to put more transistors into a square inch of silicon every year. And that holds true. There's been no diminution in that. But what's happening now is those clock speeds are not going up anymore for power consumption reasons and other things. So that the single brain in your chip isn't really getting that much faster. So what that means is so they're countering this by putting lots of brains on your computer. The trouble is the software, there's a lot of software that doesn't really benefit from that yet. And so there's going to be we're going from dual core chips now, to four core next year pretty clearly. But there are jobs that the four core computer actually does slower than the two core computer. So this is going to get a little subtle and confusing, I think, because the process of all this is there's going to be this time lag as the software catches up to the hardware, and that's kind of going to be a big issue.
But doesn't it in some ways represent a maturation that we're no longer, producing muscle cars like GM did in the 50s or 60s, and we're trying to focus more on what people actually need to get their job done?
Yeah, and there's a reason there aren't two engines in the average car,
That's true. They could go in opposite directions.
Backwards really fast.
Yeah. Well, I do that sometimes. What impact do you think Vista is going to have on the whole chip market and
Well, I don't see a heck of a lot of change in the trajectory. I do think it will have a lot of, general impact as it filters out to the way average people use their computers, but I don't think it's going to have a big macroeconomic pull or push in the whole.
It seems like it's pretty good for the graphics adapter industry that their chips are going to be in demand.
Yeah, and they are in a very, NVIDIA and those guys are becoming more interesting companies. You're going to start seeing supercomputers made out of graphics chips. I mean, they have a lot of power that's going to be used in new ways. So
we have to wrap up shortly, but just what is your biggest challenge covering this area for the journal?
Well, perhaps the number of people we have and the fact that our publication was farsighted enough 50 years ago to have electronic distribution long before the web, but yet as far as the web itself, we're not that hip in some ways. We think all our content has to be paid for, and even if Google's net worth for free content is more than Intel's now, so we're trying to work through the free versus paid thing, and I'm not sure we're doing that good at it. But that's a sort of a challenge.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Don. Appreciate it. I bring up Joel Dreyfus, the editor-in-chief of Red Herring. I mentioned earlier that I had a former boss here. I worked with Joel when he was at Information Week. But since then, he's been in a lot of other places. Fortune Magazine, he's been there twice. You were doing a project in Baltimore last time I talked to you. It's been a while. How long has it been to talk to you? But back at Red Herring now, or at Red Herring.
Yes.
Joel, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. It's great to be on your
show. Yeah, I think of myself as more of a letterman. We were actually thinking of modeling this after the Jerry Springer show, but John Dvorak wasn't available, so as a guest. Joel, you've been watching this, for a long time. Like me, you've got a couple of gray hairs there.
I have a couple of brown ones, actually.
I'm curious from your perspective of having been an observer for so many years, kind of put into context the end of 2006, the beginning of 2007, in the context of how long you've been watching this industry?
Well, this is an industry I have fun watching, and I do that by avoiding investing in anything which deals with the ethical problem and the objectivity problem at once.
And keeps you from being both very poor and very rich.
Right. So you look at it and you say, this is one of the most self-righteous industries in the world. I mean, nobody talks about money. We're always changing the world. Mm-hmm. But if you've ever been in a room in a negotiation over a valuation of a company, then you know it's about money. And money drives this industry, but doesn't like to talk about it. So for those of us who cover technology as a business, rather than as a calling, or as a religion, or as a marketing machine, it's a lot more fun, and you're able to be a little bit more objective, I think. And that's what we try to do at Red Herring.
Yeah, the last time I tried covering the religion, I think I ran into some fundamentalists, and it didn't work out. So in terms, again, going back, same question I asked your colleagues, looking back at 2006, any thoughts as to what the big story was?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of big stories is that, social networking was cacheable, mm-hmm. So And that, you know, the Google of this year, you know, was the sale, the Murdoch's purchase.
Well, well, but Google actually makes real money from business. Is it also cashable from the standpoint of actually making money?
Well, the guys who own the company made a lot of money.
By selling it to another company.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's the first
step. Well, that's nice, yeah.
So that, they've already cashed out.
Right.
So the question is whether Murdoch spent too much money or whether whoever buys the next, you know, and there are probably 200 investments in social networking right now. So we have a social networking bubble going on, and a lot of people are going to lose money, and a few people are going to make money, but that's the way this thing works, you know, here out here, is that we always like to forget that there are a lot of people who lost a lot of money in technology. Mm-hmm. Billions of value were wiped out between 2000 and 2001, but we've all forgotten that already.
Right.
You know, and I could tell when I went to a restaurant in San Francisco a couple of months ago, and they had a beautiful grand piano that was there. And I said, gee, where'd you get that? And they said, well, this company just sold it. These guys just sold their company, and they wanted a piano for the party, so they bought it.
Wow. You know, it's funny.
I said, the bubble's back.
I remember back in the late 90s when the biggest problem that people in the industry had was getting a reservation at a good restaurant. And then in 2002, their biggest problem was trying to find a job at a good restaurant. it's good to know that it's back.
Yeah.
And we have to wrap up again, but again, looking forward, what are you looking forward to for next year?
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to belittle the social networking thing. Is I think, Don, was it, we're talking about computing power and all that. It doesn't really matter very much now anymore because there's so much computing power available. And now we're focusing on what do you really do with computers besides the office functions. I mean, right. If you think about it, for the last 20 years, it's been about typing better and drawing and spreadsheets and calculations. Now we move to commerce and social interaction between people. I think video on the internet is probably the biggest transformation because up until now we were doing word processing on the internet. Primarily that as a way of communication.
But from an end user standpoint, or from our job as a journalist, that sure is challenging. I no longer walk around just with a notebook. I also walk around with a video camera, and it's a lot of work. I mean, you know, it's a different, maybe it isn't for the kids.
Wait another year, you won't have the notebook. You'll just use your phone.
Just use your phone.
You know, and so we're, you know, which is the other big transformation, which is the move away from PCs, which is what scares the heck out of the HPs and Dells and Microsoft.
And what I'm looking forward to is Microsoft just came up with a really, really easy to use version of Office. So I'm looking forward to having spent several weeks learning how to use this easy to use version of Office, which is dramatically different from the one that I spent several years learning how to use in the past. So life goes on. Well, thanks, Joel.
Sure.
Change places. And we now have. This is the hardest part of the whole panel. I knew they could all speak. I just wasn't sure they can keep track of where to sit.
It's sequential processing.
Yeah.
This one
Andrew Kluth is the technology correspondent from The Economist. He's been there since 1997. He was previously, boy, this guy's gotten around, based in Hong Kong, Southeast Asia, London. And unlike most of us, he actually knows something about the ins and outs of how to make money or lose money because he's a former investment banker at J.P. Morgan. So maybe you're the guy to ask about stock prices next year. Welcome.
Hi, Larry.
Well, Andrew, we've had the local perspective, we've had the enterprise perspective, we've had the national perspective. We're looking for you to explain the rest of the world. Economist covers things globally. What is the world thinking about this whole industry that we're part of?
Well, let me first say my apologies to Jane Anderson in the audience, because Jane, you just wasted, you shouldn't have come, because everything I'm going to say you've heard and read. And so hopefully just someone else it might be interesting. And to answer your question, when I was sent here about 3 years ago, I was really quite upset about that because I thought it was one of the most boring beats at The Economist. Because and this will probably be a shock to people in this room, but my mom, my mother-in-law, most normal people around the world find this stuff both scary, this tech stuff, and much more importantly, boring, very boring.
How dare they?
So that
that's
there's
why we keep them over there.
Yeah, really.
And I have to somehow capture those in my net, nonetheless.
Yeah.
I can't just talk to this room. And then, So for about a year, I was going about my business trying to learn the stuff they're talking about and those acronyms, and then I discovered that something was happening that did genuinely start to interest me. And that is that the Valley, and I don't think anyone sees it as such, but is really not anymore a tech center, but is becoming a new media center.
Mm-hmm.
And it, not hyphenated, new, is becoming a new center in the media industry. That's what I meant. So it's joining older, and you know, this happened before in history. New York was one, but then for various regulatory reasons, it moved to Hollywood and so forth. So there's many media centers, and the old ones never go away. But we have a new world center that affects an industry, namely the media. And that started sinking, I started realizing that in earnest about a year ago, and I realized that I hadn't thought that through, and I needed to cover that more. And so I pitched what we call a survey, a large essay in chapters on it. And then that came out towards the beginning of the year. And then this year, this past year, these things started playing themselves out and started confirming my thesis. And I think the big thing next year will be when this actually gets to the mainstream, these people that I mentioned before that think the rest of this stuff is boring. So when it stops being geeky, starts being mainstream. What is the this that I'm talking about? I've compared it before to, you know, the time period we're living through, to the high Renaissance, or the late 1400s, early 1500s, when there was a new technology that came along. It was the printing press. And really, not immediately, but through a series of unforeseeable steps at the time, started the era of the mass media,
yeah,
which then took centuries to play itself out, and which is now ending. But they never end overnight, they end in decades, and you know, and a new era of media is beginning. And I'm now, and again, apologies, Jane, but I genuinely think we're going from, the word I'm trying out now is, because it's hard to find one word to describe so many trends, but in an area of intimate media, you could call personal, participatory. And that is interesting because it genuinely has nothing to do with the, if I may say so, geeks in this valley. It really touches everyone in the world. And all of my readers, and there's resonance from all these people. So, I think that would be.
And by new media, you actually took out the hyphen.
Yes.
I'm curious why you took it out, because it sounds to me like you are talking about a new media.
Yeah, no, in that particular sentence, I took out the hyphen. In our economist style guide, there's
there's
a hyphen when there's not a hyphen.
Because
and have you noticed? I have not split an infinitive since I've been up here.
I'm impressed. Well, I'm hoping that my editors and publishers and producers at both the New York Times and CBS News heard you, because I don't think they've figured out yet that there's a new media out here. I mean, even many of us here are associated with companies.
Well, can we just briefly go through what the most interesting, and I'm not big or interesting companies in the Valley are? Google is a media company.
Yeah.
Yahoo is a media company. YouTube was bought, but is a media company. It goes on. Second Life, what is that? Pixar.
They've got their own reporter from Reuters.
Electronic Arts.
Yeah.
Jane's company, Six Apart. They're all media companies. Technorati is a media company. It's about audiences. It's about producing and consuming media content, and that's different. You know, it's not about any sort of acronym. So that's what I mean when it's a media center. And it's also a media center in the sense that the older media center from Fleet Street, where my bosses are, you know, metaphorically, not literally, but they're nearby. They're in St. James's, but in London. But everyone's taken note. The media is scared. And that's how you know that it has become a media center here.
Well, it's interesting. And I'm going to open this up to everybody now. I'm fascinated by this media issue because I think most of us, or many of us, kind of dabble on both sides. But those of us who work for major, whether it's television or radio networks or news organizations, have a certain discipline, a certain standard of ethical behavior that we're expected to carry out. Those memos haven't necessarily reached the blogosphere, yet the blogosphere can be very, very influential. So how do we, from the mainstream media, continue to operate knowing that, in a sense, we're competing with this much more free-flowing media? And again, anybody here is welcome to take that question. But
well,
don't you all,
I think the hope is that that's the survival strategy for the mainstream media, is to retain objectivity, to focus on specific things that people are interested in, which is local, what's happening in my city, my town, and to let the people in the blogosphere do what they want, but hopefully we will retain and eventually build audience by sticking to that formula of we're going to try to give you sort of the unvarnished truth. And there, of course, there is a role for everybody else out there, but I think that's the only way the mainstream media is going to survive is to try to retain that objectivity.
Well, I mean, I think there's also a piece here of essentially trying to co-opt that as well. So what you'll see is people who have brands will try to bring some of that functionality, some of that audience in underneath as some sort of an Uber brand that might be whatever it is you're working for, and to embrace that. I mean, because it's a difficult argument, even though it's totally valid, but to say we actually have some, we actually understand the truth and we've got all of these, we have certain ethical standards and all that, that's a really hard pitch to make and no one's going to believe that. So, and even though we have standards and all of that, it's a very difficult argument. So, I mean, I think what you need to do is you need to embrace some of this. You need to do some of this yourself. You need to bring in your audience and allow them to contribute in this, so it's more participatory. And then you put your stuff alongside it. And actually, it extends the story, right? Because you're creating thousands of new stories every day.
But in terms of influencers, I mean, it used to be the influencers were all from the media organizations mostly represented on this panel. And now they're out there hither and yon. I mean, it's an amazingly large field. I'm actually curious, maybe later we can talk. I know we don't have time for Q&A, but I suspect that a lot of people in this room are kind of really struggling to figure out who the influencers are, because obviously they want to pitch their stories to whoever has that widest audience.
Well, and Larry, I think one of the big questions is in this new media world, what is the role of advertising?
Yes.
I mean, when you can so easily in the new media world skip advertising, hit the little X and the ad disappears. I think there are great questions about how does that sort of content get paid for in a world where you can, not bother with the advertising.
And of course, as you and I were talking about over lunch, I confess to David that I have a rental house, and normally I would take an ad out in the San Jose Mercury News or the Palo Alto Daily to try to get a tenant. But instead, this time around, I put something on Craigslist, and before I could pick up the phone to call the Mercury News, it was already rented. Sorry, David, that was a few bucks that would have gone to you and to me, ultimately.
That's what technology is doing. It's changing that world. It's changing the world of network television. It's going to change. I assume it's going to change what Hollywood does as well as we get into this world of so much more user-generated content.
We were passing around this quote yesterday from Eric Schmidt. It had to do with the number of blogs being produced every day is like just one every second or something like that. And he says the average blog has an audience of one.
The writer. Yeah.
And then this guy said, "Mom, anybody?" and I think that's an overstatement probably, but it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, some of us here grew up. We had things like Top 40 radio. There was Ozzie and Harriet, the Isle of Lucy, something that was on TV that was kind of like everybody would be talking about at work the next day. Now, with the micro audiences that are going to be created, it's going to be interesting to see how, if that's retained or if people just really, it goes to the ultimate degree of just little tribes and nobody really is talking about the same thing. They're all everybody's in little cults.
Yeah, I remember growing up.
An issue of quality, that still isn't answered. I mean, I remember I had a conversation with Barry Diller once, and I said, "What do you think about all this user-generated content and blogs?" And he said, "I've been working with writers, and for many, many years in Hollywood." And he said, "Most writers aren't that interesting." And I think that's true of most of 99% of the blogs. But some people will emerge with talent and an ability to tell a story or with great sources. And I think we keep looking for one industry to drive the other out. As you said, it hasn't happened. We had newspapers, we had radio, we had television. Each has an effect, but then they all seem to coexist ultimately.
But what the big difference is those entries, blog entries, they never go away. So there's the long tail thing, which, you know, a TV show, you would watch it, maybe everyone saw it, but they forget about it, right? Or you couldn't access it.
Until now, Nick at Night.
Right, yeah. Okay. But see, now what you have is anything that's ever been written is still there. Okay, and so actually as a model for advertising there is to think instead of about, you know, that initial big hit, you know, over a long period of time. But I mean, I think that's also valid is that because there's kind of a weird democratization, you know, in terms of search engines, all this stuff is always there and always available and not necessarily, you know, rated.
And there's also the disintermediation between advertising and the publishing company. All of the organizations that people work for have their own advertising departments, but now any blogger can go put Google ads or other network ads on there, and if they've got a big audience and if their audience is inclined to click through, they can make hundreds or thousands or theoretically tens of thousands of dollars a month if they have a big enough audience without having to have an advertising department. And I'm curious, you know, from the perspective of the publishers here, people who work with publishers, what impact would that gonna have?
Could I start with the perspective of a non-publisher?
Yeah, well, we're not actually publishers.
All of this is wonderful, isn't it, for society? If you, I don't see the problem with any of it, neither the ethics, first of all, on the ethics, we're all in the same boat. I think everyone, you know, every blogger and every journalist does it for their own reputation, and that's what I personally worry about, so that's what makes me work hard and check things. And I think for most bloggers that have ambitions to have an audience and maybe make money in the way you just described, they'll be in exactly the same boat. And the rest of us get to decide who's ethical or trustworthy or not. So that's good.
But you know, if Don's colleague Walt Mossberg recommends a product, I don't often agree with Walt. I don't necessarily think what he's saying is necessarily to my liking, but I know that he wasn't paid to say that. I know that he's not keeping freebies. I know that he's participating in a certain kind of standard. I don't know that when I go to, you know, blog.blog.
But probably over time, that blog.guy will you know, build some credibility, I think, or he won't,
well,
based on his, you know, willingness to trash things.
When I use the word intimate media, what I have in mind is phenomena such as Six of Parts, Vox Service, or where people recommend, the micro audiences you mentioned, are really, me and my friends, we trust each other. They trust me more than any of our brands here.
Yeah.
So if I were to recommend something there, they know I'm not getting paid for it and so forth. So that problem is solved as far as that, if we're truly talking about the micro audience aspect of our personalities. And I think you'll find that most human beings have, well, all, I think one side of us, we're not experts on everything, we'll have a media need for general interest news, what's happening around the world, and we'll probably go to certain brands or bloggers or whatever to consume that. But then we have the things we care deeply about, and we'll probably go much deeper, and that's probably where we're gonna go to the internet. And we probably will go, let's say your hobby is quantum physics, you're not gonna get that from our publications, your needs will not be filled. You're gonna find the three world experts that have a blog on quantum physics, and you're gonna get electron spin or whatever. And then you have another need, which is your genuine social need, your family needs, and this is where it gets most intimate, where you want a chronicle of your life for maybe three people. And the issue of quality is a non-issue, because by definition, the ridiculously bad and amateurish pictures I take of my baby daughter are the best content, if you ask my mother. It Barry Diller and his, you
but
know,
who paid you
paid
to put
people
yeah, but
have
you
no
see,
chance.
But we're talking about mass markets here. If you're talking mass markets, there's a quality issue and there's a production quality issue, which a lot of video bloggers haven't dealt with yet.
That's for sure.
But are we talking about mass markets, or are we at the beginning of the mass market disappearing?
Or are we redefining quality?
I'm not sure your intimate market has a business model attached to it. So if it's family pictures, fine. But if it's somebody trying to reach 50,000 people, who's going to pay for that?
But some of the most popular videos on YouTube have terrible production values.
Right.
And are we redefining what a production value is, that this crap by TV standards can reach an audience of millions?
Maybe it's funny.
There's a difference between sort of a single hit, you know, a funny video on YouTube, and repeated visits. I think the market is incredibly efficient at sort of rooting out the crap and elevating the quality. I think that there's still a tendency, for all the talk of the long tail, I think that there's still a tendency to flock to quality. And I don't think that hits go away. And you know, back to your earlier point about having all these blogs out there, how do they decide who the influencers are? I mean, this is the easiest job in the world, I think. I mean, you just you watch the traffic. You watch, you know, where people are going. I mean, just because there are a billion blogs out there doesn't mean that there are a billion blogs that matter. You know, and quickly, the people who, you know, you're right, once upon a time, the only outlet for people who had sort of journalistic tendencies were at these organizations. Now there's much more opportunity, but they're not doing it in a vacuum, right? I mean, they're influencing other people, and, you know, in some ways, you write something on a blog and you're just, it doesn't even exist unless other people think it's great and then forward it to their friends and they forward it to their friends. And so, as I say, I think the market is incredibly efficient in sort of raising just the boats that are, you know, are qualitatively different.
There's a real interesting timing issue here, though, because things happen so much more quickly. I remember when Zillow was introduced. You know, it wasn't all that long ago. And like 2 weeks after it was introduced, everyone I know had gone to this site to look up how much their house was worth, right? And I mean, it was instant. And then there were stories about, oh, actually the evaluations weren't so good and people stopped going there. And it's, so which, I mean, and I'm, it's still a popular site, I understand. But, you know, like 3 weeks can be the life cycle of a site or a blog suddenly just shooting up. So trying to cap, I mean, Should PR people be trying to capture that peak at 3 weeks? I would say yes, but that's actually kind of tricky.
Well, again, I mean, so if you have a 3 week blog, then it's flash paper, and it sort of doesn't matter. Yeah. And, you know, and so I know that you're all running faster than you've ever run before in your life, and so are we. And so you have to step back and take some, you know, perspective. But this is what I'm saying. I mean, this is where. We're also focused in the here and now, but I think that the way that this is shaping up is just, the quality is rising, and so there are people who people who work for established companies, newspapers, magazines who matter, and then there are people like, you know, Michael Arrington at TechCrunch. I mean, we can talk about his sort of, you know, loose ethics, they draw traffic, you know, they aggregate eyeballs, they offer opinions that matter. And then, you know, if they lose the trust or they lose the quality, then they go away. It's part common sense. It's part watching traffic. It's watching what other people say about it.
But it's interesting about brand. I remember my first kind of big job in the industry as a writer. I got to write a column for the LA Times. So here's this guy, this young guy, no credibility in the world. But suddenly, I'm a syndicated columnist for the LA Times. Instant credibility. Everybody in this room works for a publication that has incredible credibility, which kind of rises you immediately. But in this world, that credibility doesn't come necessarily. I mean, people are their own brands. I mean, Arianna Huffington is not only a brand, but now she's hiring a reporter away from the Washington Post. I mean, what does that say when a brand can kind of be created overnight to challenge a brand that may have taken hundreds of years to build?
I think she filled, I mean, in those cases, I mean, the wonderful thing about all this change is the ability to have so many thousands more points of view than were available. I mean, as somebody like him, who's lived outside the United States for a number of years, we have an incredibly limited range of political dialogue in this country compared to everywhere else. I mean, we have two major parties and everybody else is fringe. I mean, you know, in other countries, you negotiate with three or four parties just to form a government. So there's a much wider dialogue. And what something like Huffington's a good example of a political landscape that was pretty limited in its dialogue. And here's a woman who I guess is a turncoat conservative who not only went to the left, but went fairly far to the left by American standards and found an audience and, you know, had a great audience critiquing, saying the things about conservatives that even the liberals didn't want to say, you know, on mainstream television or mainstream. You know, I mean, I always watch CNN and wonder which one is left and which one is right.
Right.
You know, so
it's easier on Fox.
So I think, again, so I think content, I mean, what people feel, you know, it's not just a marketplace need. There's intellectual needs. There's emotional needs. And I think blogs, video, homemade video, user-generated content will fill those different needs. It's not just about markets. I think the second question is, what will generate large enough audiences to be self-sustaining businesses? Or do they just get acquired by Murdoch? you know.
Could I add something on the loaded word brands that you used? And everyone seems to be terribly interested in what the future of various specific brands is. And I what's the big deal about brands? Brands represent essentially a certain people standing behind it and what they make it. They're hard to build up and they're terribly easy to ruin. And if it were the case that certain mass media brands that we're familiar with were to suffer or even disappear, why would the rest of us care? Why would even the people employed by them care? Because they will go on, there's more new opportunities being created for them. The other thing is new brands are springing up. So I want to ask you, what is Slashdot for a certain demographic? Is that not a brand represented by certain people? How is it different than The Economist? As you get further into this revolution, the things that seem new look more and more old and conventional to me. It just is a longer continuum. And there are certain brands in the mass media that I hope will disappear very soon, personally.
Well, I probably...
And will be replaced by some of these sexy new brands. In general, a little bit of turmoil in the brands and the people moving back and forth is a great thing. I really look forward to it.
Well, I probably get some freelance income from some of those brands that you want to see killed. And aside from my vested interest, I mean, when I pick up the San Jose Mercury News or the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, or even turn on CBS News or NBC News, there is a certain comfort that I get. Maybe it's a false comfort, but there's a certain comfort I get from the fact that these folks are operating from 20, 40, 50, 100 years of tradition. I know that they play by certain rules. I know what their standards are. Maybe I'm living in a fool's paradise. I don't know.
Well, I just want to ask you, what do you think about the Times of London, which had this terribly ancient, beautiful tradition in the English-speaking journalism world? I happened to be in England when it was taken over by Rupert Murdoch, and everyone agreed that overnight this ancient brand, so you know, the years behind it, just went poof.
Yeah.
And
so, Andreas, something else. Is it a zero-sum game when these other brands go away? It's the same number come back to replace them, or do we? I mean, because there's only so much attention that we have. So how much space is there for you know, multiple brands, because we're talking, you know, incredible explosion.
In my opinion, right now, especially in America, it's one reason why I didn't buy a TV when I moved here, because it gives me a headache. It's unbearable. It wastes our time. It wastes our attention, which we don't have enough of and time of. Now we're with this cacophony in the new media world.
Yeah.
We will figure out something that will, ironically and counterintuitively, at some point start to seem soothing, because Well, people will be wasting our time less. We will go where we think we find worthwhile opportunities to interact with a content producer.
But speaking of soothing, I grew up, and I'm going to show my age now, living in Los Angeles, even as a kid, watching Walter Cronkite and reading the LA Times. Certainly my father every night would watch Walter Cronkite and would read the LA Times. And you'd go to school the next morning, and everybody's parents, or perhaps even every kid, was influenced by Walter Cronkite or the front page of the LA Times. Are we lacking a kind of common denominator of information?
Oh, we have Jon Stewart.
Jon Stewart, right. Or my daughter gets most of her news from the pop-ups that come up on AIM when she logs on. And I worry how easy it is to skip the front page. You know, we're not watching the evening news, you know, any one of the big three networks. We're tuning in to whatever we're tuning into. Could we as a society lack kind of a cohesive understanding of what's going on in the world?
I was the owner of a 20-year-old and a 23-year-old, so to speak. I should say, may they own me, perhaps. I think it's interesting because I have these two beings that have just grown up in this entire milieu we've been talking about. And, you know, and I think one of the things is, you know, our kids, is the average kid reading, you know, anything other than, say, I Am from his friends? I mean, are they interested in the world? Are they going out and getting engaged? And I think it's a little hard to say right now. I mean, I think that the habit of picking up the newspaper is definitely weakened, you know, and I think is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's a definite fact. You know, the habit of reading a book is challenged.
And I'd add something about newspapers. I think a lot of the old media is to blame for its own problems. I think they're blaming the internet for things that, I mean, how many papers in this country are incredibly boring? You know, yeah. Incredibly boring papers to read.
But the trouble is whenever a newspaper then tries to get readers, you know, a real circulation war, you don't want to read the evidence. Right. You know, that's when you have to have lotto games and hide the buried treasure in town, and everybody digs up and goes out with shovels. I often say journalism and newspapers is the one business competition makes worse. You know, because you know you're rushing to get that story. You don't check your facts. You talk about. Eva Longoria's wedding.
But I'm even talking about what are they interested in? I have a 22-year-old. What is he interested in that he'll see on the front of the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or the LA Times? Probably not much, you know. And when they do it, it's stilted because it's done by the people. I remember when a reporter at the New York Times wrote about Smokey Robinson, you know, the Miracles retiring. And the copy desk guy with the green eye shade came walking over to her and says, "What does doo-wop mean?" You know.
But what scares me about that?
I mean, I think it's what Andreas was saying about the mass media is sort of disappearing. We're going to have fewer and fewer mass media. It's just like we have, you know. Well, we had for a while fewer phone companies, but there's more consolidation. But who would ever have imagined 20 years ago that, you know, 15-year-old kids would be walking around with telephones in their pockets and all the things you can do on a telephone? You know, we're getting to where you can use your telephone for transactions. And, you know, technology is just driving a whole lot of things that are getting rid of the mass part of it, and it's more of the personalized, more of the ability to share things with your friends through technology. You know, we see big company like Cisco, which has sort of taken this gigantic ship and moved it, and is slowly moving it from a networking company to being a video company. You know, a company that hopefully delivers video to the home. And so, you know, I think there is this recognition that in a way, the technology industry used to be driven by big companies, enterprises. Now it's driven by consumers and people who, you know, have their own personal
And what does it mean when
needs.
These micro audiences are global? You know, for example, my son, you know, he had his band up on MySpace or one of those places, you know, a little Oakland rock band, and you know he's getting emails from Germany, you know, about his new song. I mean, you know, this is very interesting. I think these now classrooms are going to be connected. You know, we're going to have all kinds of dialogue. So what does it mean when your little audience is clustered in many geographies?
Well, there's more opportunity to touch. You know, there are many more touch points, right? The problem is they're not. It's not in, you know, mass, so it's harder to reach because it's not in one place, but well, many more opportunities.
One of the things it means is that maybe for your local news, you're going to have to go to the San Jose Mercury News, the Palo Alto Daily News, or, you know, that free giveaway paper that the Washington Post is, you know, I mean, there's a whole, that's the other thing, is that there is a growing, I mean, I happen to write for the Palo Alto Daily News, but that's actually it's a growing phenomenon in the newspaper business, these sort of ultra-local publications, and maybe that could be an opportunity.
Maybe written by the local residents as opposed to professional journalists.
Well, unfortunately, for whatever it's worth, a lot of these papers are very laden with AP copy, but they are written by, they have local reporters, sure.
Andreas said something, I don't know if he really meant to, but that
Probably not, I really do.
The person who leaves the big media and his brand goes away and then he just gets another job, that's a question I, you know, David's going to lay off some people next week.
That particular question is an interesting one. I'm teaching at the journalism school in Berkeley, and my students are just frightened in a way, but they're also not all frightened, and we would be here for days. But whenever anything gets disrupted, and the only certainty over history is that things are disrupted, when the disruption happens, some people get scared. Then some people then suffer, and then eventually things will move on, and we will even forget the pain we went through during the first industrial revolution and the second one and before that.
Sure. All I'm saying is that, you know, for this class of professional class of people with a certain union job and a certain income level, I'm not saying they die. For the macro economy, of course, in the long run, we're all dead, right? So it doesn't.
But wouldn't you agree that for you, as a good writer, and a good, ultimately, what is a writer? It's a storyteller. As good storytellers in this panel, I would not be. In fact, I'm quite confident that there'll be a new golden age of storytelling. Whether it happens within these brands sitting here, I don't care.
Will it be
but
text?
So let's say there is a golden age of storytelling, and what's needed is good storytellers. Now, Don, I think you could just, you know, walk out and start telling
your
stories.
I could write a story, but would anybody pay me for it?
As well, I think
you'd be surprised that in time, you know, Don Clark could become a name relevant to maybe few, but important people, and that you'd make a very happy and prosperous living.
Here's the thing. You know, back in 83, we were hiring...
Would you go first, please?
Right. We were back in 83...
You and I should talk afterwards. Right. Who knows?
Back in like 83 or so, we were paying freelance writers at Omni, you know, a dollar a word. Guess what we're paying them now?
Less.
Some of them get a dollar a word. So I don't know what you tell your students. I mean, I would probably tell them, consider another career. Realistically, it has. It's certainly that sort of structure has not exactly kept pace with the economy.
My son just graduated from journalism school in Colorado, and
he's
a TV broadcast guy, and he got a job as a TV reporter in the town of Chico. He's actually every night on the TV news, or, you know, as I said, covering car crashes and meth labs. You know, and for him. So he's not making any money. You know, he's got a job. He's probably not making much more than the guy at McDonald's. But that's
probably a good transition for us. Those of us hopefully won't have to be covered. We could cover the technology of meth labs, I guess. How to build one.
More
we need to wrap up in just a few minutes. So I'm going to give everybody in the panel, beginning with David, just a minute to kind of summarize what they want to leave this great audience with.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, Don mentioned Moore's law, and he's right about how clock speeds aren't changing, but the technology is advancing so that everything is getting smaller, more mobile, more ability to do more things with a device. You know, there's this rumor that Apple is now looking at a phone, iPod. I think the technological change is going to happen, and the amazing thing, particularly about being in Silicon Valley, is you just don't know what the future is going to hold because innovation occurs. I mean, 10 years ago, if I had gone to somebody at Apple Computer and said, in 10 years you're going to be a music company, they would have said, you're nuts. But the reality is, you know, innovation causes things to change. As Andreas said, you know, the disruptiveness, it's Clayton Christensen's book about the innovator's dilemma. How do you continue to put out a good product yet continue to adapt, you know, to the new world is the biggest challenge that companies face, particularly here in the Valley, where everything changes.
And just to comment on your Apple, and it was actually not even Apple's credit. It had to do with the changes in the disk drive industry and the display industry and the battery industry, none of which Apple had anything to do with, but they figured out how to capitalize on it.
Well, and the really bizarre thing is, take a company like Sony, which had a music division, it had a hardware division, it had the Walkman, but they couldn't figure out how to do what Apple did, which had never, you know, which wasn't in any of those businesses.
Exactly.
Just to follow up on that point, I think that actually the music industry is a great metaphor for what's happening with media now. I think that this whole discussion, I mean, we could continue all day because it affects our livelihood. We are talk about an issue that's boring to most people. You know, this is it, I think, you know, the plight of the media. But, you know, I think that, you look at what has happened in the music industry over the last, 10 years, and especially being at Wired, we absolutely reviled the music industry for their inability to embrace change, you know, to fight the consumer movement, to stick to, you know, antiquated hardware and distribution and, you know, the labels. I mean, the labels are the brands, they are the media. It's the same thing that's happening here, you know. It's just, we're all going through change and it's painful, but it's gonna be good for everybody in the long run. That's just a quick follow-up on that. In terms of what's happening in the Valley, I mean, what I'm looking for right now is, I think that there's gonna be an amazing second wave of innovation that comes out of Google. And I don't think it has anything necessary. It's going to be sort of the son of Google, you know, the grandson of Google. You're starting to see people leave the company.
granted, stock is still going up, but you know, this company is hiring people just to lock them up. You know, brilliant bioengineers, bioinformatics, people who are just sitting there doing absolutely nothing all day. These brilliant people who are pulling their hair out, and they're gonna leave. They're already leaving. And they're gonna go out, they're gonna take their millions, and they're gonna just, there's gonna be this like second and third wave that's coming out of Google that I'm just really excited about. I'm just really fascinated to see what's next.
Great, Steve?
So, you know, we've been talking about the, you know, what's happening in the, you know, with media and all that, but actually, you know, on a kind of broader palette, it's much of the same. And the story of this year, the story of last year, the story of probably the next several years is really about the job market and outsourcing. I mean, this is the thing that is most roiling the waters and most frightening my readers. Frankly, you know, we all try to pitch the story in different ways and make it a little less threatening. But the reality is this, not only is this not stopping, it continues to accelerate in huge swaths of work for, certainly for IT guys and others, are being moved, whether it's near shore, offshore, or just into other companies. It is the story that affects everything. And what gets more interesting is, I would say a lot of the offshore stuff is really moving up the stack to much more complicated sort of work. You know, we used to, in the U.S., we would in the past we'd say, well, it was just, you know, it was scut work and it was call centers. Like, no, that's not where this is going. Frankly, a lot of this work is moving offshore, and it's much more complicated. It includes business strategy. It includes stuff high up the technology stack as well. That's kind of the story and will continue to be for quite some time.
I would see if I can sort of splice what I was thinking onto what Steve was saying. But the biggest change to me since I've been covering the Valley since 86 has been the closing of the IPO window. You know, whenever I was coming here, everybody had a dream they could sort of be the next Apple, the next Intel, and they could go public. I mean, Google is the example of the past 6 years, but I don't think anybody's going to say Google is the rule, it's the exception. There is an exit strategy, which is to be bought by Google or somebody. But the economics of that is not the same for either the employees or the VCs. They don't get, you know, 100-fold kind of payoffs. So that changes the dynamics of how many companies are formed, what they go after, you know, how they plan. I mean, I think with YouTube, for example, they were a company that it was just, I think they always kind of knew they would really never have to get the business model built, because you know why replicate the perfect Google advertising engine? You know, it just slide it right in there. You know, and so I think that's going to have a long-term impact. And getting back to what Steve said, and one of the reasons the IPO window is closed is because of regulations and things like stock options going away, Sarbanes-Oxley. If some of these, I don't really think the IPO window is going to really open that much anywhere else either, but say, for example, startups in China, startups in India, where you actually start to have world brands emanating from those countries for products and things start to happen. I think it's going to be sort of interesting to see if, you know, still the Valley is unique, I think, in terms of its crucible of innovation, but if that IPO window stays closed, and I don't see it ever really going to open the same way again, you know, what that's going to mean. Are other valleys going to open, or I just raised the question.
Well, I'd add to the international thing. I think the most important development is the global, what's happening globally in technology, and it's still beyond outsourcing, I think, which was a story we did, yeah, is that you're seeing many more centers of innovation in India, in Israel, in China, in Latin America, we're beginning to see some things there. And then the IPO market has moved elsewhere too. I mean, so there's more on AIM in London. People are looking at doing IPOs in Shanghai and Hong Kong and Tokyo. Japan has had a couple of hundred IPOs in the last year, about, you know, a third of them are tech, but they have a pretty lively market there. So it's more global, it's more dispersed, and yes, Silicon Valley remains where the most money is for investing in startups, and even companies do come here from Europe and Asia to get financing. There are centers of financing evolving in other places, and that's making it harder to follow and harder to track, but a lot more exciting to see as well.
Well, I started with a historical look at the media, so I feel I should end it there too. I just want to try a thought experiment for context, which is, imagine the media before this invention that I was talking about, the printing press, so the Middle Ages going back towards antiquity. You'll find there was one mass medium, which, in the Western world at least, the Bible, and it was hand-copied by the mainstream media, that was the monks. And it was read by almost nobody because no one was able to read. So actually all the exciting, interesting media that was going on was in small, interactive, intimate micro-audiences. And out of that world comes a shockingly large proportion of the media that we consider classics. Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, folk songs, poetry, you name it, Petrarch. That was from the pre-mass media era. And at some point, I'm not saying next year, but maybe 20 years, 50 years, 100, we'll probably look back at this strange aberration in human history, brief, very brief, a few centuries, called the mass media. And what were we thinking? And students will try to figure out how it was possible that we arranged our lives to be at a certain time of the day, you know, in front of a certain gadget, and how lonely, and so forth. So I have this strange feeling that we're going with some genuinely new, unprecedented things added to something much more harmonious, natural, biologically natural. In other words, back to a media culture that we were meant for. And therefore, and that sort of, that leads me to guessing without any evidence to corroborate it whatsoever that the best days of storytelling are yet to come.
Well, I appreciate that, and I also appreciate, I do worry that future anthropologists are gonna look at 20th century man and wonder what those white things in their ears were and why everybody was going like this. Well, I wanna thank the panel, it was excellent. I wanna thank Paula Dunn for being a great producer. We don't have Paul Schaefer in the orchestra to send us out, and I don't know if we have a late show, but I do want to also thank everybody in the audience. I wish we had time for interaction and Q&A, because that's ultimately what this is about, but we all have email.